Well, I know we're starting a little bit late, but I'm going to try to push us ahead. My name is Morgan Reed, and I'm the Executive Director of the Association for Competitive Technology, and we are here to talk today about cost and everybody's favorite topic, money. I think it's important to note when we think about all this, and we heard earlier today from both Glenn on the kinds of devices that he's looking forward to putting into the marketplace, what we in the tech sector refer to the Internet of Things, and then we heard Blair talk about the costs of getting the kinds of devices that people are going to want, getting that connectivity into those devices through the whole United States. It's clearly going to create a lot of opportunities for people to make money and for companies to take risk and spend money, as well as for the government to end up playing a role in how those assets are utilized. Futurist Ray Kurzweil has used a quote. He says, "The price, performance, capacity, and bandwidth of information technologies progresses exponentially through multiple paradigm shifts." Kurzweil refers to this as the law of accelerating returns. And we all know every form of communication is doubling in price, performance, bandwidth, capability every roughly 12 months. So when we think about this, we need to ask ourselves the question, how do you figure out the cost given our demand projections? And let's look at those. We all know 1980s, the Slater phone, the all-important Zach Morris giant handset. When we look here, that's what we started with on the left. It made phone calls. It weighed a ton. As we heard, it was $1,000 and a buck a minute. And you get to the end, down to the iPhone-ish type device on the end, we know that it does everything that all those other devices do, and the same amount as the laptop that Tim's sitting in front of, plus a whole lot more. So we've massively changed our devices and their capabilities. They've gotten cheaper and faster. So how much more so? I don't know if this might have a little too much glare on it, but basically what we're seeing here is this is the rate, and this is a logarithmic chart of the growth of the U.S. phone industry. Down here in the 1890s is tiny, giant shooting up. This is in dollars and calls per day. The red line is revenues, and the blue line is calls per day. And this is a log chart, folks. This is not just regular. If you look at the estimated cell subscribers, again, this is logarithmic. You see down there in the bright spot there, that's 100 million, and then it goes up. It's flattening out, not because we haven't been successful. We're running out of people. So right there, the cell phone subscribers, we are now running out of people to cover with all of this. This is one of the things that I think drives together with the two. This is mass use of inventions. Down here we have telephone, we have radio, we have television, mobile PC, mobile phone, and then kabam, we see the web. Huge change in the number of people in the amount of time, the number of people that are using new devices, specifically the web. Ginormous change in what we're using. Price performance, we know that this is another easy to see logarithmic chart. This shows us in bits per second from 1990 to 2004 in a logarithmic scale how much better we're getting for the dollar we're paying. And internet data traffic, we've all seen this. We know it's another. This is in petabytes per year logarithmic mean. And up here, that's 10,000 petabytes per year in internet data traffic. So is that all just people Facebook updating? No, it's not. The e-commerce revenues on this are extreme. If you look, the blue line is business to consumer, and the red line is B2B. And those are in billions of dollars. Again, we're seeing we are now logarithmically over 1,000 billion. Actually, we're quite a bit over that, for those of you from England. In our business-to-business money on the web. And we're well over $100 billion a year on our business-to-consumer. So those are our numbers. Those are the charts. They're all in log. None of this is in regular form. This is logarithmic growth. So how the heck are our panelists going to tell us what it's going to cost to keep up with these rates of growth? Well, fortunately, we have a lot of smart people who can lead us on the way to figure out how to estimate these costs. We start off here. We have Richard Bennett with the Information Technology Innovation Foundation. Richard is a 30-year vet of network engineering and having contributed to standards and protocols for Ethernet, Wi-Fi, and the Internet. So when your Wi-Fi works, you 802.11, you owe some love to Richard for that. And when it doesn't, you can call him or email him.
Not my department.
And he's currently a research fellow at ITIF, an independent technical consultant, speaker, and writer. Next over, we have Tim Donovan. Tim Donovan is with the Rural Cellular Association, and he serves as their Director of Legislative Affairs for RCA. And his membership is mostly made up of rural and regional carriers with less than 10 million subscribers. We have Scott Walsing, who you heard the shout-out today from Blair. Several shout-outs. Good on that. He is the former economics director for the FCC National Broadband Task Force, vice president for research and senior fellow, Technology Policy Institute, and a senior fellow at Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy. That's three jobs. One's former, but at least two current.
I'd like to make sure nobody knows where I am.
It's better that way. Well, we heard there's a tracking device that you can wear around your neck. And well, we hope you won't be wearing one of the Glenn collars. And finally, Charles McKee with Sprint. Charles is the vice president of federal and state regulatory affairs for Sprint and the Nextel Corporation, and is responsible for all non-spectrum-related regulatory matters before the FCC and state commissions. And with that, so we've got pretty much everything covered. We know the numbers are tremendous, so let's talk about costs. With that, I'd give each panelist about 5 minutes to run through your stuff, and then we'll go to questions.
Yeah, I'm not really sure why I'm here, because I don't know anything about what makes things cost what they do, but I can tell you about some things that sort of generally get overlooked in this discussion, and that is, before anybody climbs a pole or pulls a wire or erects a tower to build a mobile network, there has to be some technology developed that makes that mobile network feasible. And the costs of continually improving the technology, developing the technology, actually drive very strongly the cost of deploying the network and the utility that the network can provide. One of the lessons, I think, from the last 30 years in the evolution of the Internet and in the advent of the mobile phone is the value of standardization in networks in terms of reducing cost. And what we learned from the Internet is that if you build one network that can do multiple things, you end up with an incredible efficiency. Well, I can't exactly quantify it. I think some of the people that have more of a handle on the economics could do that. But the efficiencies that you get from building a single network that can serve multiple purposes for multiple people at the same time are enormous. And in the case of the Internet, we've built a worldwide fiber infrastructure that mainly rides on top of a technology called MPLS that permits Internet traffic and private network traffic of various kinds to transit a common fiber infrastructure around the world through undersea cables, across continents, from internet exchange points in major cities to neighborhoods. And the fact that the investment that it takes to pull that fiber can be leveraged and can be paid for across multiple applications is really quite important. The continuing to develop the technologies that allow us to get more use out of the existing fiber, to get more use out of existing copper wires where they're installed, and to get better use out of spectrum are a key factor in reducing the cost of providing higher capacity mobile networks going forward. And some of that technology is basic research, which is sort of hard to, it's hard to really, fill the void that was left in the United States when IBM and Bell Labs essentially ceased to be the monopoly-funded pure research facilities that they had been. And there's a role for government there in stepping in to ensure that basic research doesn't fall by the wayside in the U.S. Applied research, is also important. And one of the major areas in innovation policy that ITIF works on is figuring out how to take technologies from the laboratory to the marketplace. And by reducing the barriers in terms of regulation, by helping to provide reasonable returns on investment, that critical step of reducing the cost can be accommodated. Once a network is really established, like the Internet is, there's a sort of a paradox in that it becomes difficult to improve. Because when too many people are using it and they expect it to work a certain way, and it runs up against perhaps limitations in the basic design, it becomes difficult to deploy the enhancements that to take it over the next hurdle without sort of breaking the applications and the patterns of use that people are accustomed to. And so that's one of the areas in technology that we have to understand better how to transition from less efficient uses to more efficient uses. And the costs of that are, they're difficult to calculate, but, you know, they are part of the overall picture. I think I've probably used most of my time. Operations expense, obviously, and maintenance are important, too. And, of course, one of the downsides, the last thing I'll say, is that one of the downsides of having multiple purpose networks is that they are more difficult to maintain, more costly to operate than single-purpose dedicated networks like broadcast television.
Tim, take us to the rural country.
Great. Thank you, Morgan. It's great to be here, and I want to thank the Advisory Committee and the Internet Caucus for putting together such a great program, and it's an honor to be on a panel with such accomplished speakers. RCA represents rural and regional wireless providers throughout the United States, with membership consisting of carriers that provide service in rural markets and serve less than 10 million subscribers. We firmly believe that mobile is the future of broadband, and that's a sentiment that we've heard from FCC Chairman Jenikowski and others in the administration, and I'm sure is shared by most of us joining us here today, or else we wouldn't be here today. The sentiment is also emphasized in the National Broadband Plan, specifically stated in the second goal that the United States should lead the world in mobile innovation with the fastest and most extensive wireless networks of any nation. Not expensive, extensive. This is a tremendous concept, and one that the actualization of will ensure that we are positioned to continue to be the source of great innovation and untold developments in the coming years. For those in rural America, this is one that carries great potential for enhancing the quality of life, including huge accomplishments in public safety, educational opportunities, remote working, and developing machine-to-machine technologies. Even within the past couple of years, we've seen some M2M technologies that would allow remote controlling of a plow that can keep lines straight enough that you can go across acres and acres without having any deviation. And it's little technologies like this that can greatly improve life in rural America and the productivity that we can have. Some research has shown that the wireless 4G, to get down to the cost, can provide service for around $900 per household, but we've also seen some mobile deployments which can reuse existing towers and other infrastructure in rural America that can deploy broadband at faster speeds for as little as $275 per household. Now, that's pretty great. That's when the infrastructure is in place and you can build over top of that. Mobile wireless deployments can also reach have a wider geographic reach, which also broadens the size of potential markets for broadband. As FCC Commissioner Michael Copps has said, wireless broadband service can offer cost-effective connectivity where no broadband exists, as well as complementary or competitive service where it does. And we really think this holds especially true in rural America. Beyond the initial costs of deploying the wireless broadband, those in rural America are also facing additional challenges that impact the ability to provide the ubiquitous mobile broadband throughout the nation. One of these aspects is the impact of handset exclusivity agreements, and specifically what this has on the smaller carrier. While these may be viewed as marketing devices, we've seen as high as 46 of the top 50 devices covered by exclusive deals. It's widely accepted, and I think everyone would agree, that today's cutting-edge devices, which put broadband in the palm of your hand and in your pocket while you're on the move, help drive the deployment and use of mobile broadband. In order to continue driving this, you need to make sure that that technology is able to be in their hands of those throughout the country. When you take the devices off the shelves for small carriers, consumers in some parts of the country then must choose between having robust service where they live and having the latest device that's driving the buzz about mobile broadband. The lack of access to some cutting-edge devices can result in a slower uptake of some of the technologies for those in rural America. Another significant building block for ubiquitous mobile broadband that we're seeing great progress on is the issue of data roaming. Looking around the room, I think that most of us would be disheartened, to say the least, if we were cut off from access to email and various apps just because we were away from home. Yet, we have to make sure that some of the smaller carriers are able to obtain these data roaming deals. This is something that was addressed in the broadband plan and one that we've continued to support. As the plan stated, few, if any, networks will provide ubiquitous nationwide service entirely through their own facilities, particularly in the initial stages of construction in rural areas. As some small rural providers serve customers that are more likely to roam in areas outside the provider's own footprint, the plan goes on to recommend that the industry adopt voluntary data roaming arrangements. This is something that we encourage and we try to foster, that our members do reach out to the large national carriers and make sure that data roaming is in place so that the mobile broadband is capable for more people. If we follow the pattern of 3G networks deployment, which will likely be the case for 4G, We see that some rural areas are a little bit left behind, but once you add data roaming into the equation, you're having it so that the smaller companies are building out their territories with the faster mobile broadband at the same time as the national carriers are developing as they would like to, and together you have a faster and a more cost-effective method towards ubiquitous national broadband. And with that,
you got 30 seconds, but if not, we'll take it back. Scott?
So thanks for having me on this panel today. This is an interesting topic. And, you know, I have no idea how much it's going to cost to build this out. I think in part because, as Blair said, we don't know how the market's going to how the market's going to evolve. A few years ago, we couldn't have predicted that there would be 150,000 apps for the iPhone and, you know, 40,000 apps for Android phones and so on. And, you know, hopefully, we can't predict now what's going to be 3 years from now. And how the market evolves is, of course, going to affect the kinds of investments that we need. And, of course, and also costs of those investments, of components of those investments will change over time. And that's all good. That's part of a dynamic industry. But it makes it very hard to predict. Another thing we really don't understand is today what demand looks like. We know how much people consume. You can measure that. But we don't know how much people are willing to pay, to put it in economics terms, for different types of broadband, what they're going to want to do tomorrow. You know, how much are we going to need really robust 4G technologies, and how much are we going to need sort of ubiquitous mobile coverage for things like machine-to-machine that may not need lots of bandwidth but need every little piece of area to be covered. We just don't know those things. And so we want to make sure that that the market works so that it can provide incentives for investment and make sure that policies also help encourage incentives to invest in these networks. And there are, I think, two components of that as we go forward. And one is one that Blair talked about and others talked about, which is spectrum. We have to bring more spectrum into the market. But it's not just the case that today there are users of spectrum who aren't doing the most efficient things possible. That in each, you know, every constantly over time, the most efficient, the best use of spectrum changes. And so the use of spectrum has to be able to change over time, too. And so, you know, whatever policies we implement now that allows spectrum use to change over time, spectrum use to be flexible, that has to be something that can work going forwards. So it's important to get more spectrum into the market. It's also important that secondary markets work well. And actually, they work much better in the U.S. than in any other country, really, I mean, by orders of magnitude. But that's not to say that it works well. I mean, if you try to find out who owns what, it's, you know, it's really, really difficult, although the FCC's new spectrum dashboard is a nice start, although you still can't follow trades on it. So that's one thing. The second part is something that people don't talk about a lot, but it relates to demand and what we don't know, which is pricing. Pricing is going to matter an awful lot in how these networks get built out. I don't think the providers yet really know the right way to price, and I think we will see lots of experimenting with it. On the voice side, we see sort of, you know, two trends. One is more and more people buying prepaid. So they're basically doing pay-as-you-go plans. And then other people who are moving towards totally unlimited. And, you know, we don't know what that's going to look like in the data space, but we can imagine, but we just don't know what will be most appealing to consumers and what best facilitates investment. And one reason why this is important is because pricing is also an important tool for managing traffic. And we see that in every other aspect of life. You know, if you travel on the metro at rush hour, you pay more than you pay during other times of day. Cliff Winston at the Brookings Institution has some nice research on congestion pricing, the effects of congestion pricing on highways, on roads. And he's looked at the effects of investment on the actual infrastructure to see how effective that's been at reducing congestion versus potentially using tolls at dealing with congestion. And he's found that basically every dollar over the last decade of investment in highways and the infrastructure has reduced congestion costs by about 11 cents, whereas a dollar toll has reduced costs by about 60 cents. Those can be a much, much more effective way of dealing with some of the congestion problems. And why that's important is because resources are limited. We're not going to be able to just invest unlimited amounts so that everybody can use their iPad all day long anywhere in the country. And so we have to figure out ways to efficiently allocate these resources. And so when pricing is done in proper ways, then it frees up some money that may have gone into, say, a very dense urban area to go into a more rural area, say, for example. Or it could be the case that consumers hate it, and they all want, you know, people only choose all-you-can-eat pricing. We just don't really know yet. But that's going to be a huge component. 30 seconds, wrap up. That's going to be a big part of it. So making sure we get the incentives right for investment, which involves both spectrum and prices, is going to be important.
Charles?
Great. Thank you very much. I always love speaking right after lunch. I don't have any good jokes for you today. I meant to look one up, but I was late getting out of the office, so we're just going to have to jump right into the advertisements for Sprint. It is my job. They pay my paycheck, so I'm going to have to start out talking a little bit about what Sprint does and what we're currently doing in broadband, the mobile net. Sprint has currently coverage over more than 275 million POPs. And that includes 3G EVDO coverage, roughly 93% of our network is EVDO Rev A, which gives you download speeds of 600 KB to up to 1.4 megabits per second. That's a very useful service. There's a lot of discussion about what is broadband, but that's certainly a service that I use all the time when I'm traveling and is a very effective kind of broadband service. But realizing that the demand curves we see here are where we're headed, Sprint has also now deployed the only, we are the first nationwide carrier to deploy a 4G network. And we currently cover 30 million POPs with our 4G network. We should be at 120 million POPs by the end of the year. And that 4G network runs with download speeds of 3 to 6 megabits per second. And the difference between what you can do with a 3 to 6 megabit mobile network and what you can do with a standard DO network are really quite breathtaking. And one of the things that, you know, folks here have talked about a lot of the different technology developments. One of the other things that you have to keep in mind is you build a bigger pipe and the application providers build bigger applications. So they fill that. They fill those pipes up as fast as you can create a faster pipe, something that we have to keep in mind as we're building a network. When we look at the costs of constructing and operating that network, a lot of people think of wireless as simply, you know, this magic that happens in the air, and it goes magically back to our network, and we then connect with the internet. But, of course, we try to minimize the amount of time that you spend in the air. We try to minimize the amount of time that you spend in the transmission path between the device and the tower. And once we get to the tower, we've got to bring that down to the ground, and we take that traffic through traditional routes, through point-to-point connections that are part of the existing landline infrastructure.
I like the magic explanation better.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly more fun to have the sense of mystery whenever you turn on a device. How does this thing work anyway? I'll tell you what, CDMA technology, I think it's just phenomenal. But not to get distracted with that.
It's a lot like magic.
The backhaul costs of operating wireless networks are tremendous, and they're going to get even more tremendous as we need larger and larger bandwidth to haul. You know, the principles of economics that you talked about are very important there, because there's going to be a limit to what consumers are willing to spend for these data services. But the demand that they are going to, or their expectations are growing exponentially about what they can get for the same dollar. And that means that we're going to need to deal with the cost of hauling that traffic. Right now, backhaul represents about 30% of the cost of operating one of our towers. That's going to only go up as we have to add more and more backhaul to those towers. Now, having to get in my pitch here, one of our concerns Sprint has expressed fairly forcefully with the FCC, and they did recognize in the National Broadband Plan, is that most of those backhaul networks are owned by two companies, and they happen to be our competitors. And we have a real concern about those competitors leveraging those facilities to increase costs to their competitors and draining money away from other mobile providers that are trying to enter into that field. So we have concerns about making sure that we have access to those facilities at reasonable rates, just and reasonable rates, to use the magic language. And that's going to be a big driver that we're going to be looking at closely as we move forward with our deployments.
Well, I think we've got to heard it all. I like the use of magic, although sometimes I feel like what we're really doing when we're looking at spectrum is we're trying to put 2 pounds of meat in a 1 pound bag as we continue to compress and compress and compress our data. But I think what we have to look at now is really what's the topic du jour for Washington, D.C., which is jobs. We've talked about billions being spent. We've talked about billions at play here. Where are the job growth potentials here? Where do we see the economy from the build-out? Who gets jobs? Where are they? And how far does it extend? Anybody want to start the first stab at that one? Scott?
I'll start at first by being provocative. Usually, I think most of the jobs numbers that people toss around with regard to telecom stuff are just nonsense. This stuff doesn't generate jobs. The investment does. The investment component, you've got people putting up towers and building lines. As long as there's slack in the employment in the labor market, which right now obviously there is with such high unemployment, those are probably jobs that wouldn't exist otherwise. But in terms of how the technology itself will generate jobs, I don't see it. The studies that show that are really, really flawed. When you look at sort of the broadband and job studies, for example, usually they're just looking at a correlation between economic growth and broadband, and they were done, a few years ago. The economy was growing, broadband was growing, poof, you got a positive correlation. You can redo those same statistics over the last couple of years, the same studies over the last couple of years, and the economy was shrinking, broadband was still growing, the correlation's negative, but nobody would assume that it costs jobs. The thing is that, and another part of it is that you hear people say that these technologies will increase productivity and create jobs. Well, what is higher productivity, right? we had the example of M2M allowing a tractor or something to be driven without a person. Well, one fewer job, no more tractor driver. So the point is that these, I think, this is not to denigrate these technologies, because these are, economy-changing, really game-changing things. But you don't have revolutionary change in an economy without some difficulties that go along with it. And to think that you'll only get new jobs out of this is not true. We'll all benefit over time, but that doesn't mean you're going to get a billion new jobs right away. It's going to take time for the economy to transition and figure out how to make best use of these technologies.
So who makes the $24 billion that Blair talked about today, or the $350 billion that we all know isn't the real number? Where do those end up going?
I mean, that's what he's talking about. Those are the build-out numbers.
Right.
You've got to take a person and dig something, put something up. Those are jobs.
Poles and holes.
And that's what I was, and that's what I was saying actually are, right. Especially with such high unemployment. Very clearly, those would be jobs.
But on that same topic, Richard, how do we get the technology that makes it possible for us to dig poles and holes? Where are the growth numbers there? Are we doing enough to spend money in the places that it's going to give us the kind of multiplexing technology that we need? And where do we need to spend?
From the analysis that I've been able to do of the growth of sort of internet traffic in general and mobile traffic in particular, the bottleneck is the middle mile. But I think the bottleneck there is infrastructure, it's not pricing. I mean, if the issue is that you have, when people use 2G wireless, you put up a tower, you had a single T1 serving the tower, you were fine. You could, keep up with 1,000 users with a single T1. But if you have 4G on the tower, and for 4G deployments to really be successful, the towers themselves have to be deployed a lot more densely so that you have a much lower number of users per tower, because it's just sort of physics that the whatever spectrum you have can support a certain amount of aggregate bandwidth. If each user has a bigger chunk of aggregate bandwidth than the previous technology enabled them to have, then you need to have more towers. And that's, you know, that's how you make that. Fundamentally, that's how, I mean, it's very simplified, but fundamentally, that's how you make the capacity available. Now, you know, that single copper pair is not sufficient. So, okay, so the next solution is bonded copper pairs. So you have 8 or 10 pairs, and then you aggregate that up, and you get 10 to 12 megabits per second per tower. You know, and that's okay up to a certain point, but then, you know, you reach the point where, I mean, sort of the goal of spectrum, of everybody who's doing network engineering is that they want the part of the system that they're working on to not be the bottleneck. So if you're the guy that does the wireless stuff, then you figure out how to increase the throughput of the wireless part of the system, and then if you used to be the bottleneck, then that shifts it somewhere else. And so now it's the middle mile guy is the bottleneck. You know, and there you need to have fiber. And when you get to, you know, you look at the market for who provides fiber to businesses, and that's what towers are, part of a business. You know, it's not the old telephone company monopoly primarily that's doing that. In urban centers, certainly in Silicon Valley, there are a lot of private operators that pull fiber. You know, and that's kind of the, so it's, The investment in that middle mile infrastructure, that's where it comes from. It's not traditional, you know, the traditional phone companies. I think out in the rural areas it may be different because there's the market's not big enough for, you know, somebody like MFS to want to get in there and start doing that. But that the whole issue of getting the permissions and the regulatory approvals and everything and the access to the facilities to pull the fibers through, it's just a complete mess. And I'm kind of glad that the broadband plan didn't really go into that a whole lot because that would have ended up dwarfing, you know, everything else.
I think the important, though, thing to think about is that what we traditionally use fiber for today are aggregation points where we've got large amounts of traffic. So, for example, Sprint has constructed its own fiber rings within metropolitan areas precisely to pick up that aggregated traffic. The concern that we voiced has been with respect to the tail circuits or however you want to, refer to it, getting to individual tower locations, and it's precisely the concern that you expressed there. It's the cost associated with those rights of ways, getting the regulatory approvals, getting access, digging up streets, that makes it so prohibitive to get to a location. And right now, there's only one entity that has existing conduit, holes in the ground, access to buildings that have, they can get into almost every building, and that's the incumbent LEC. So for them to pull a fiber thread through that existing conduit is a relatively small incremental investment, as opposed to a new entrant to come in and try and duplicate that infrastructure.
Well, I mean, I agree it's easier for them, but it's not impossible for other people to do it. And I think, you know, what's behind this is the issue of, do you guys own your own towers? Or do you lease space on other people's towers?
We own some, we lease some.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's the way this marketplace is developing is that there are three fairly sizable companies that do nothing but build towers, right? Crown Castle and there's a couple others. And that's their business. They build towers and they lease space on the towers to, mm-hmm. you know, to Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile, and whoever else mm-hmm. is in the marketplace.
Although they don't generally provide backhaul.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that I think there's a market opportunity there. If you're going to build the tower, and we understand the tower is sort of a cooperative, I mean, when it's leased, it becomes a shared facility. The backhaul is too, and I think they're understanding that simply putting the tower up is, you know, is not enough. I mean, their customers, you know, actually all ask them about the backhaul, and in some situations they actually provide backhaul through microwave or, you know, various techniques like that. But, you know, I agree that's an area in which it makes sense for some industry cooperation. It makes sense for certain third parties to get into it. There's some entrepreneurial solutions, and there are regulatory dilemmas. But it's sort of what you want to do is force the ILECs to make an investment in that part of the infrastructure, which is something that regulation doesn't traditionally do. And, it, you know, and this is what concerns me about some of the calls for special access reform, is that it seems to be an attempt to reduce the return on investment. Well, maybe that's okay if it only applies to copper.
Well, let me ask. I mean, both of you are saying that access to rights-of-way is a big deal, and we know that that's true. I mean, rights-of-ways are controlled by all kinds of different entities, and it's really difficult for anybody who's not already there to get into that. I mean, it's no mystery why Google and its fiber build is looking for a city that will make all of the rights-of-way issues go away, because then I mean, it's just so hard to deal with. But then, Richard, it sounded like you were almost backing off the importance of that it was enough to just have one. I mean, do you think that this exhibits natural monopoly characteristics? Is that what you're...
Well, I think my perspective on it is sort of warped by my local knowledge of how it's done in California, where it's very permissive and companies can easily get access, and we have multiple providers of middle mile fiber. And I don't think that's in the Bay Area of California. It's kind of hard to draw too many generalizations from that there to the rest of the world. And so I'm actually just trying to understand what the situation is like in other parts of the country.
I mean the response that we would have to the question about investment is that there's an incentive there by the ILEC to keep the cost of providing that service inflated, at least because it gives them a competitive advantage in the marketplace. So if they can keep our costs high, it's an internal accounting issue for their own services. And so, and it, to the extent it draws money away from us to them, that's a way to help fund them and give them more return. Yeah. The question is if this is, in fact, effectively, to use the term natural monopoly, however you want to characterize it, if there's an advantage there that's built in, then that's the time when the regulator needs to step in. Not to say that there shouldn't be a return on the investment, which nobody has suggested. It's been never suggested they shouldn't be making plenty of money. But the rates of return that we see are so phenomenally inflated that that's where we have the concern.
But I think the inherent problem that you have is that you're essentially saying that you want to tell them how much money they can make, and that's something that's very difficult for anyone in a marketplace to be in. And since there's no one here from those companies, I definitely have heard the argument that, wait a minute, we spent the money, we built it out, so we kind of get to determine how much we charge it for. But all being understood, I think you made your point very well.
They built it out over 100 years on a monopoly rate base and recovered that cost.
But I think, I don't want to spend the whole time worrying about special access. I think that's definitely an issue that's prevalent here in Washington and one that we all know is pretty major. Slightly off that kind of the in-the-weeds stuff, what are the areas that the government needs to either spend money or help out in making this a reality? I mean, we all talked about the mobile broadband, and I was just joking that my iPad over there, my 3G iPad is love my AT&T stuff, but I'm sorry, guys, it's going to crush your network. Because I'm sitting at home watching watching a movie on Netflix.
We just have to keep you off your iPad.
That's right, exactly. The problem is that we've all seen from the numbers we showed earlier, this is the reality. I mean, people are, my app developers that we represent at ACT, they're the ones who are going to make the new apps. They're the ones who are going to just crush your networks. So what are the things that we need to do at a higher level in the longer term to do it? I'm thinking of things like the R&D tax credit. What does the government need to do to put more education in it? There's this whole other field of activities, H-1B visas, et cetera, that businesses probably need to have some foresight into as to making sure that we do get ubiquitous mobile broadband. Anyone? Education, H-1Bs, R&D tax credits, anything like that?
Yeah, all that stuff is good.
Right. We all agree. We'll adjourn to the bar.
The 500 megahertz of new spectrum is helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we also should, I mean, in terms of spectrum, we have to keep trying to get the government to give up some of its spectrum, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, every administration tries, and every administration fails, I guess because it's kind of scary to order the Defense Department around, because then they have guns.
They can bomb you?
Right. Yeah.
They'll waterboard you anyway.
Right. Not anymore. That's been officially banned. Well, if we have, if we have ubiquitous mobile and agreement about the need for some of those other activities, we should at least throw, we can throw it open to questions, but I wanted to give Tim at least an opportunity. I know we talk about, the government clearly can't pay for ubiquitous mobile broadband everywhere, and it seems to me that there's almost two minds in the rural space. There's the individual farmer who's 3 to 4 miles from his neighbor, square miles from his neighbor, The ROI on him to get him significant bandwidth is ridiculous. We heard it earlier today from Blair. It's in the billions. But there are a lot of rural cities, little towns, like if you look at the Western District of Minnesota, the largest city in the Western District of Minnesota is Moorhead, 32,000 people. And that's for one congressional district. How does ubiquitous broadband help the folks in Moorhead or the companies in Moorhead compete with businesses in the Twin Cities?
Well, it provides the opportunity for them to do a lot more with what they do have, even being that distance and being able to reach back. Now, to go back, you talked about the cost difference and making sure that it gets there. There is a lot of money being spent by the government right now to make sure that that's out there, and we do need to make sure that as those programs go forward in the second round, whatnot, the first round, if you look at a recent report, 11% of the funds went to wireless technologies. And if you're looking to make a mobile broadband, and that's what the forward-looking future is going to be, you need to make sure that then the government subsidies also reflect that.
So you think that we really need to flip the spending and move more of our spending into the mobile broadband, into the wireless broadband space?
You need some more. I don't know if flip is exactly right. You aren't going to have the robust wireless network without having the problems of bringing it back, as we've been talking about up here. So it is important to invest all around, but I think you could go a little bit more than 11% on the wireless side.
All right. And with that, I'll open it up to the floor. Questions? Comments? In the very, very back.
Hi, Eric, can you hear me? I'm Craig May with National Journal. What did you mean, by backhaul capacity? Forgive me for not being a technology expert. I don't understand what that means.
Oh, just the amount of... I handed out a glossary to everyone, so sorry about that.
Yeah, it's hard to have a telecom conference without speaking gibberish.
It makes you sound like you know things.
Yeah, exactly. If you just use the lingo fast enough, people can ask questions.
Yeah, we get graded on that.
Well, basically, between a tower and a switch, you've got to have a point-to-point transmission facility, and that hauls different bandwidth. So Richard was talking about, you started out with traditional voice services was over a T1 or a basic twisted copper pair, and that could carry a relatively small amount of data. And then you have to continue to add capacity, either by adding additional twisted pairs of copper, or eventually when you need even more bandwidth, then you add fiber or some other technology. But the point being that voice takes a relatively small amount of space on the pipe. And right now, an average tower probably can handle about 70 simultaneous voice calls. But if you then start adding on HD video or all these other large bandwidth uses, one of those things can wipe out all the space those 70 voice calls took up. So as you offer all these great things, you also increase the need for more space on those pipes going back to your switch. I mean, some of the devices are going to be really cool. So Sprint just announced its new 4G phone, for example. And this is just to give you an example of how you're thinking about what you can do with these networks changes. And my jaw dropped when I watched them doing this stuff. But there's, for example, there's this feature on this new phone, the EVO, that's called Google Goggle. I don't know if that rings any bells to anybody.
Yeah.
But just this cool application. And it can work only because you have a combination of a very high-resolution camera in the device. It's an 8-megapixel camera in the device. And you have the data speed to be able to send that information back and forth quickly to the device. So the way Google Goggle works is you take a picture of something, a structure. So, for example, you take a picture of the Eiffel Tower while you're standing in front of the Eiffel Tower. Well, it then sends that information back to Google that then runs a search as if you had typed in the Eiffel Tower in the little bar on Google, pops up the search result instantly, then you can touch the links and go to anything that you want to know about the Eiffel Tower, including their animated website about the Eiffel Tower. I mean, a more practical application, you're in a wine store, you take a picture of the label of the wine bottle that you're interested in, and it instantly puts up a Google search result for that wine, including you can go to the vineyard, you can do this and that. I mean, the concept of mobility and speed and device all combining to create services that, frankly, nobody would have thought of even 2 years ago.
Of course, I should point out the absolutely frightening amount of privacy and security issues and things that they know about you when you have that, but that's just the paranoid part of my brain.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, there are some actual devices on other things besides Google. I've got one that I can show folks here, a stargazing program that you can actually hold up in the sky, and it positions itself in the sky and can actually tell you what stars you're looking at, the stars next to it. You move it down, see where things go. It's generally
referred to as... Of course, with that one, you have no idea if they're right or not.
Pardon me?
Without you have no idea if they're right.
Well, some of them... But it's generally referred to in the industry as augmented reality, and it is definitely something that's going to tear up a lot more bandwidth. So it sounds like what Richard was saying about that middle mile is definitely something we're going to need to work on. Other questions?
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yes, you may. We got one more audience question. Del Bianco?
Richard, you talked about the need, whether it's backhaul, middle mile, or radius of the tower. Don't let it be the bottleneck. It's an engineer's credo. And I'd like if the panel could explore how one figures out if you're going to be the bottleneck and measures it. It can't just be number of users and megabits of capacity where you look at some dial and see how close it is. It's got to be measured in terms of user satisfaction of the application. Can't just be about avoiding the bottleneck because of capacity. A lot of it's going to be intelligent prioritizing, or else you're going to be the one with the bottle around your neck.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that in principle, especially with packet switch networks and datagram protocols like IP and sliding window rate control systems like TCP, there's always going to be a bottleneck. Right. I mean, if the whole network was completely transparent, then the CPU, the processing power of the endpoint computer becomes a bottleneck. I mean, there's something that prevents you from doing everything instantaneously at the speed of light. and whatever that is the bottleneck. You measure it, you can determine where it is, you know, in the network by looking at where packet drops take place. I mean, there's more packets being presented to a link than it can carry, then they're going to get dropped, and so that, you know, that's how you identify the bottleneck. But you're right in this, and I think there is an economic implication behind this, is that, you know, what we find on large multiple purpose networks like the internet is that a very small number of applications and a very small number of users are actually consuming the vast majority of the overall resource. I mean, it's 80-20 and 90-10 rules that is what you find when you analyze the traffic that's generated by users on large networks. And that's, I think, where this issue of congestion pricing, you know, has to really become part of this marketplace, where the flat rate model that we have right now is something that, you know, a lot of people like, but then, you know, we've heard that for voice services, a lot of people are going to the prepaid model because they kind of have a pretty good handle on what their consumption is. They don't want to overpay. Flat rate model in some sense really discourages investment, I think, because it provides what's very close to a free ride for that really small minority of people who heavily use the network and sort of make resources less available to other people.
That's me.
And there's some technical work being done in that area. The Internet Engineering Task Force has an experimental protocol that they're developing called pre-congestion notification that actually allows the network to tell an application that he is causing congestion on the network and give him a choice about what he wants to do about it. And IETF is not enacting the policies, but they're providing this framework so that a network operator has the option of saying, okay, you're causing congestion by using this particular application. Do you want to pay in order to get priority access through that bottleneck, Or are you running something where you're downloading a file and it's going to take an hour anyway and you don't really care, and you know the thing that you want is just you'll use available bandwidth after all these sort of higher priority, more urgent uses are taken care of?
Doesn't that become even more pronounced with spectrum issues? I mean, you can only buy, you only have so much spectrum, so you can't build bigger spectrum in your area.
Yeah, I mean this is one of the points I brought this up last year at this conference, that there is this sort of assumption, and internet engineering has always been completely sort of blind to questions of efficiency, because throughout the deployment, throughout the deployment of the internet, the costs of bandwidth have been radically falling. And so, you know, you can build a system that's really a good test bed for innovation if you don't have to worry about the efficiency of particular applications, if bandwidth is relatively close to free. But, you know, in the mobile world, that's never going to be the case, because it's not as simple as pulling another wire when you run out of spectrum. You have to build more towers. It's a lot more expensive.
Scott, I guess, if there are any more questions from the floor, otherwise I'll give Scott the last word. Scott, the last word.
The last word on this topic? I thought that question was really interesting, because we use the word bottleneck a lot, and it's actually kind of hard to define it. Because if you're using your cell phone and ultimately it's connected to a fiber, obviously,
CPU,
and then, right. So how are you gonna overcome those? And I mean, prices have to be a big part of it, especially in mobile, like Richard was saying, because in the wired space, what's going to matter is how growth changes relative to how cost per bit change. But in wireless, they're not going to change it that quickly. Still growing, so yeah. I don't know. That's a great question.
And with that, so now we know the bottom line that we learned is we have no idea how much it's going to cost. We know it's going to be cool, and we know it's going to be ubiquitous. And managed. That's right. All right. With that, thank you very much, and I'll close the panel out.